Hello, everyone. Good evening. My name is John Palfrey, and just delighted to see such a crowd out here for our good friend Jonathan Zittrain and his book release, The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Much more on that in a moment. Welcome to the Tribeca Grand. We at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School think this is a very cool place to be in New York City. This is a little hipper than we usually are. But
you'll see our turnip truck parked outside.
That's exactly right. Jonathan has rattled down here from Cambridge. But before turning to Jonathan, I wanted to introduce the co-host for tonight's event. We are extremely blessed to have many good friends in all parts of the globe, but particularly so in New York City. Professor Susan Crawford from Cardozo Law School is one of the great minds of the internet law space. She's also just been scooped up as a tenured professor at the University of Michigan, where she's headed westward. We hope we'll see her just as much as ever before, but she's one of our co-hosts and was going to say a few words for starters. So, Susan.
Thank you very much. And I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for coming. And I get a chance now to sing the praises of not only Jonathan Zittrain, but also the Berkman Center for having put together effectively the intellectual center for our field, so the water cooler around which all of us can gather. They're extraordinarily generous, constantly holding terrific roundtables and seminars and conferences, galvanizing real activity in a space that needs it desperately. I'm particularly excited about their Open Net initiative, which both Jonathan and John are deeply involved in, where they look closely at censorship around the world, the many countries that are censoring the internet, and they have a lot of detailed information about what's going on. It's invaluable. And that's just one of many projects that the Berkman Center is involved in. Personally, I'm pleased as anything that they've been interested in One Web Day, which is a global Earth Day for the internet that happens every September 22nd. The idea is to have teach-ins, lectures, talks about what you'd like to see in the future of the internet, what you want the internet to be in the future. And the Berkman Center has really dug in and done some wonderful things in connection with One Web Day. But what I'm most glad about tonight is that I get to speak before Jonathan Zittrain and not after, because he is the preeminent speaker in our field. He prowls each hall where he speaks. He'll make you think more deeply about the importance of an open internet than you ever have before. So thanks again for being here. Thanks particularly to the Berkman Center for their role as our water cooler. And we're all looking forward to Jonathan's talk.
Thank you. We will invite you back again, Susan. You say such nice things. One of the events that Susan references that I would invite all of you to is next month, May 15th and 16th in Cambridge, Mass. I hope you'll join us for our 10th anniversary events. And more on that, to talk to any of the Berkman Center staff. We'd love to fill you in and invite you to that. And our second co-host of this event is Debevoise and Plimpton. We have been blessed in all manner of regards, but this is one in particular worth noting, which is that Bruce Keller and Jeffrey Cunard, the sort of twin giants of the internet law space, in one in New York, one in D.C., have been teaching in our program at the Harvard Law School for many years. They have volunteered. They deserve a huge pro bono award for the number of flights they have, while living in New York and D.C., come up to the Berkman Center to teach a generation of Harvard Law School students how it's really done, both in the classroom and through our clinical program. They've also been generous donors and supporters in every possible way. And Bruce Keller, I'm just so grateful that you're here and for all you've done today. Thank you.
Right. So it is I who am honored to be one of the co-hosts of this event, along with Professor Crawford and my partner in absentia, because he's late, as always, Jeffrey Cunard.
You can tease him when he gets here.
I look forward to that. In fact, it is Jeffrey who made sure that I got his notes and his great thoughts out on pen and pencil so that I could not forget to recite them to the crowd in anticipation of his being late, because it's not an uncommon event.
The digerati you are, right? With
it is really just a pleasure to be here, because we have had, as John mentioned, a long association with the Berkman Center, and it is one that has we've benefited from immensely. I can't think of an issue that we haven't had to face in our daily practice that hasn't been thought about by the Berkman Center, that John and John haven't ruminated over, and in fact helped us work our way through. it's really quite a privilege. And the work that we also did with the clinical program is probably the most fun I've had in practicing law in the last 10 years, because the clinical program at the Berkman Center is engaged in some very great work. If you take a look at the website, you'll see some of the projects that they've completed. And there's a real pleasure in reaching out to students even before they get to firms like Debevoise and Plimpton, and teach them how to translate the policy issues that you're deeply involved in and make that transition into how does that translate into everyday practice of law. It's not easy, but it's a lot of fun, and you do a great job of it. So without further ado, as soon as people filed by the good professor, I think I'll turn it back to you so you can introduce him and we can be awed once again.
First, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And for anyone here who hires counsel of the Internet Law Sort and hasn't yet hired Debevoise, I encourage you to do it. They're quite wonderful.
They have a table next to the book table.
They do not, actually.
Sign up.
But yeah,
I'm injured there. In an accident?
No. An Internet.
That table will be in front of the book.
So the star of the show, our great friend, our great colleague, Jonathan Zittrain, just over here. I can't wait to hear him tell this story. For those who haven't met Jonathan, he is one of the smartest, funniest, sweetest, best people you ever will meet. He has been working on this project for no doubt more than a decade. He was in the 1980s a sysop on CompuServe, so maybe this in fact dates back two decades. He was one of those people who the cartoon on the Internet, Nobody Knows You're a Dog, was made up about. He was 12 years old or something and was running a major part of the Internet at the time, and they eventually discovered this and propelled him onto stardom at the Harvard Law School and Oxford thereafter. Jonathan was the founding executive director of the Berkman Center, went on to become a professor in very rapid time. He was scooped away from us a couple years ago by Oxford University to become the first chair in Internet governance, and we are still trying to bring Jonathan home. So this is a recruiting event for us, trying to encourage Jonathan that his primary affiliation should come back to the Harvard Law School. But the project that he's going to tell you about is, we think, a watershed event in the understanding of Internet law, and we're delighted to have Jonathan come and tell it to us as it is. Professor Zittrain.
Thank you, John, and Susan, and Bruce, and thank you all for coming out on this terribly rainy Friday. It's just so nice of you to come here with only the promise of a little free speech and free beer. So I hope we can make it worth it. I usually benefit from low expectations, so I'm a little nervous myself now. But you've made me very eager to hear what I have to say, so I guess I should get it started. I will say that the book, the official book release is on Monday, and pieces, dribs and drabs, have started coming out on the net. Network World just did an article about it that got syndicated into Everything Else World. I guess there's just like a, they own the trademark on the world, so they just syndicated it through. And I'm just amazed, you know, as somebody who, along with my fellow travelers, often celebrates the great qualities of the Internet and the people on it, dogs alike. The comments at the end of those little articles, you know, in the, like, leave a comment section, which some of you may be leaving right now for all I know, I've been called a moron more times in the past 24 hours than at least that I know of all the time prior. I think that means that I've got some stuff to say that really isn't the usual on the one hand, on the other hand, if things don't get better, they could certainly get a whole lot worse. Thank you, goodbye. But I'll leave it to you to decide whether I'm a moron. And if you're thinking that, I especially welcome you to ask a question instead of posting a comment, because maybe we can sort it out beforehand. All right, so let me give you a sense of what I'm thinking about the book. And the way I've been sort of framing my own thoughts about it is to just take note of the fact that in North Korea, the radios by law must be designed or modified so that they can only tune to one of three stations: the Kim Jong-il Party Hour, the Kim Il-sung Reflection Hour, and Rhythm and Blues. And, like, that's it. And you just, there's no dial to find stations in between, like Radio Free Korea sort of thing. And there's actually this plan in South Korea to take solar-powered handheld FM transmitter radios and actually float them across the demilitarized zone, where you might find yourself then with a real radio capable of getting outside your bubble. And so just hold that in mind for a moment while I now tell you a little bit about a trajectory of technology between two points that I hope it's not too cute by half, but I've coined terms to describe it because open and closed and some of the other, free and not free, don't quite seem to capture it for me. It's a movement from sterile technologies to generative technologies as we go through the 20th century. So this is Herman Hollerith, and in 1880, he was a clerk for the United States Department of the Census. It was his job to count how many people there were in the country, and it was the most boring job ever. And while he was doing it, he thought there had to be a better way. And inspired by things like the Jacquard loom here on the left, where the holes would indicate where the thread should go by machine, and by a simple train ticket, where a hole could indicate your privileges and your restrictions, he got the idea of having a simple punch card that you could use if you were interviewing people for the census, and you could punch holes to indicate their nationality and the spouse's nationality and age and all sorts of things like that. You could then take the cards and put them into this, a machine that he designed, the automatic tabulating machine, and it would help count much faster. In fact, it was used in the 1890 census, and it took it from 7.5 years, dangerously close to the 10-year interval at which the census is run, down to about 2 years to do the tally. Not only was it a technical innovation, but his business model was an entrepreneurial one. He rented these machines to the U.S. government instead of selling them at $50,000 per machine per year in 1890 dollars when the dollar still meant something. And this machine transformed things. Part of his deal was he would be responsible from soup to nuts as to how the count would go. If there was any problem, there was the 1890 equivalent of a toll-free number you could call, and it would be Herman Hollerith's job to fix it. He ended up merging his company, the Automatic Tabulating Machine Company, with another. It was eventually renamed International Business Machines. And after a brief foray into the sale of Browning semi-automatic rifles in the early 20th century, it returned to the business of business. And this card is the direct ancestor of this card, which you would put into stacks like these, complete with a diagonal line so that if a frenemy of yours should throw it on the ground, you'd have some hope of reassembling it in the order in which it was originally accustomed. And you'd then put it into machines like this, the IBM System 360. This is an amazing machine. It's a general purpose computer. Depending on what's on the cards, it can do pretty much anything. On the other hand, this is a machine that radiates, "Don't come near me. You will die if you try to use me." And it was part and parcel of a business model at IBM inherited straight from Hollerith, which was, we rent to you, business, a solution to a problem you have. We're not selling you hardware. We're not selling you software. That's an afterthought. It's up to us to use these machines that might be in your basement to solve your problem, but you're not supposed to go near the machines, which is how we can guarantee you a consistent solution to your problem and take responsibility for the whole thing. Not a bad business model, but it makes these machines what I call sterile because they're not going to do anything special or new or surprising without the assistance of men in lab coats. It's a kind of machine that can't surprise you with third parties that tinker with them after hours, very controlled environment. Here's another machine from the 20th century that I also count as sterile. It's the Friedman FlexiWriter. It's like a Royal typewriter, except it has this thing along the side where as you type, it makes holes in the tape here, and then you can run the tape back through, and like a player piano, according to the holes, it will type whatever was on it. It also means that you can cut and paste your way to a mail merge more easily than you can with Microsoft Word. Very useful piece of equipment, but also sterile because you can't reprogram it. The way it behaves is the way it behaves from the day you get it to the day you throw it away. Still useful, not bad. I like this thing. I like its descendants. Here's after it got bought by Burroughs in the 60s and 70s. Here's after it became the Brother Smart Word Processor. Anybody write term papers on this thing in the 1980s? Yeah, good times. You'd power this up and you'd get the main menu from Big Brother, and anything you could possibly want to do as a consumer with information technology is awaiting you. You can do typewriter, or desktop reference, or disk application. Any of the things you care for are there, but the main menu is the same from the start to the end. Now that makes it a sterile technology. In 1977, a watershed event happened that put us into the realm of what I call the generative. Images are fuzzy from this era, but this is Steve Jobs as a 21-year-old wearing his first suit introducing the Apple II personal computer. For the first time, you had a general-purpose computer in a convenient plastic molded case for which, when you turned it on, you got a blinking cursor. And then you could type 10, print high, 20, go to 10. Hilarity ensues. It's like, great time. But it meant that you could program it yourself. It didn't void the warranty to reprogram the thing. It was meant to do whatever you wanted to do. In fact, off the assembly line, it was basically useless. But even if you weren't a programmer, you could find other people who were, and then they could just give you the software and just say, stick this in the slot and press one key, and now you're running software from a third party. This was amply demonstrated a mere 2 years later, when in 1979, Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston invented VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet ever. So these two guys invent the spreadsheet. Businesses are like, oh my God, we've been waiting for the spreadsheet for 1,000 years. They go nuts. They start buying Apple IIs. Apple has to do market research to figure out why their computer got so popular. That's the hallmark of a generative technology. It's one that two guys somewhere can invent something new, and everybody's happy, everybody wins. He's not the only person working on this stuff. Around that time, Bill Gates, 1977 as well, was getting pulled over by the Albuquerque Police Department for speeding. My favorite aspects of this photo are, first, he's grinning from ear to ear, knowing he'll buy and sell us all someday. And second, his sense of fashion has not changed significantly in 30 years. These are the kinds of people that brought us generative platforms. They're young, they're nerdy, they're asocial, they're poorly dressed, they're brilliant. And they saw more the unpredictable power of that technology than the companies in a position, including Brother and Sperry Rand and, yes, IBM even, what it could lead to. What it led to for 30 years after 77 was this, the general purpose personal computer. So much the medium in which we swim right now that we don't tend to give it much thought. It's just sort of a background fact of life. I do see people in the back. Feel free to come on down. There are some seats to be had. And there's a little staircase there, too, that probably the fire marshal doesn't like. And you can tell that it hasn't changed very much. This is a model, of course, from about 1992 or 93. You can date it by the presence of the 66 light here. Nerds in the room may remember the 66 light and the button next to it. What happens if you press the button next to the 66 light? Turbo! Yes, exactly. Prince of Persia goes twice as fast. And the hamsters on the wheels inside are running and panting to keep the machine going. I can't help but tell you that there's now a hamster-powered paper shredder available. You can put the paper in the top, and the hamster runs on the wheel and shreds the paper, and then lives in the paper afterwards. So reuse is a viable alternative to recycling, one of the green messages of today. The fundamental characteristic from that machine in 77, in 93, in 2007 is this. You hand it code, it runs the code, no questions asked. The code can come from Dan Bricklin and Bob Frankston, it can come from anywhere, and that's what we like so much about it. It's what gave us the entire off-the-shelf software market and the market of software for people who couldn't get into the software store. Just share it. Send it on a floppy disk. Who knows? Maybe you're a Tasmanian named Peter Tatum, and you invent a way to get Windows 3.1 machines on the internet. And of course you name it Trumpet Windsock. What else would you call it? And then you just make it shareware, and you send it out to the world. A Tasmanian brought us the internet on the first Windows machine and sent it out one postmarked letter at a time. There's a similar movement from sterile to generative in the network space. In 1993 or 94, chances are good if you weren't a nerd, the way you would get online is through one of these services. Certainly was the way I did. It was, you know, Prodigy or AOL or CompuServe. And you would log on to CompuServe, and it was meant to be for non-nerds. It's like, here's the main menu. It doesn't get more basic than this, but where would you like to go today? We've designed the buttons. We've designed the icons. We have extra large buttons. You can elbow the mouse over to where you want to go, click, and then what you see will also be a function of what we think you'll like. There's nothing terrible about this. This is great. This is designed to help consumers. Great system. And yet one that, to the surprise of the executives at CompuServe and AOL and Prodigy and Minitel, got overtaken by a completely different kind of network. Talking about the internet, of course. These are three of its founders, John Postel, Steve Crocker, and Vince Cerf. pictured for their Newsweek 25th anniversary retrospective picture about their founding of the internet. They were classmates at the same high school in Los Angeles. So we had the French club or the debate club. They had the Let's Build a Global Network club. And their refreshments chair was very successful. It was a great club, and we've benefited from it. They're showing here that you can build a network out of just about anything. It doesn't work. It goes from his ear to his ear and his mouth to his mouth. A couple weeks ago, Vint assured a group of people that this was an inside joke, not that the founders of the internet don't know how to string tin cans together. But the network that they built is an amazing fluke. It reflects a particular set of important constraints and freedoms at exactly the moment they were puttering around with it. The constraints is that these guys had no money, nor did anybody want to trust them with money, except maybe the government. You know, the National Science Foundation, the counterpart to, you know, the NEA, which makes Republicans mad by giving money to people that do things about religion that aren't fun, they have a counterpart. The NSF gives money to people like this and just says, you know, go do something interesting. So they did. And the network they designed, because they didn't have money to build one from scratch, said, we'll subsume any network that wants to join us. And in fact, if you're already on the network, somebody else can join you, and we'll just say they're as good as on the network themselves. It's more like elephants from trunk to tail than it is everybody connecting in to a central source. A little more formally, they pictured the network as an hourglass, and it was only this narrow part in the middle, internet protocol, that they concerned themselves with. At the bottom, it's broad because you can bring any form of physical medium to the party and it will work. At the top, it's broad because they don't care what you do with it. In fact, this is a network with no main menu, with no investment in content, no partnerships with the AP to bring you news behind a big oversized button with an icon, no CEO, no business plan. And precisely because it had none of those things, they had the freedom to do anything. And you ended up with far more content on the network with no plan for it than on all the other networks that were so carefully trying to groom the content according to market forces. The way the internet works is so bizarre, so unlikely. The way to move a packet from the front of the room to the back, instead of asking somebody to come and do it for you, that's the way you would do it if it were the Postal Service or if it were CompuServe, you just say, we are the change we've been waiting for, or whatever it was back then. And I'd hand it to Susan, and Susan would hand it back to Jim, and Jim would hand it back. And you'd realize that you could be part of the network, handing it one person at a time. This is how internet packet routing works, right? Best efforts routing, also called send it and pray, or every packet an adventure. And that's why a lot of people say there's just no way this thing can scale. It's not going to work. IBM, as late as 1992, was telling its customers you couldn't possibly build a corporate network using internet protocol. And that's why they say their motto, the people who designed the internet, would be, we reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code. And their mascot, the bumblebee. Because the bumblebee's fur to wingspan ratio is clearly far too large for the thing to actually get off the ground. And yet, the bee flies. I'm pleased to say that only 2 years ago, they finally figured out how bees fly. Lots of federal funding went into this as well. And suffice to say, they flapped their wings very quickly. So just as there's hourglass architecture for the net, I say there's hourglass architecture for the PC, and I don't even care what the operating system is. The famously proprietary Bill Gates is just a poorly dressed asocial smiley nerd inside. He writes Windows, you can run whatever you want on it, and Microsoft doesn't care. And that actually, there's about to be a moron, I can tell, a moron comment, that is. I'm not calling people morons. Let me be clear for the camera that I was not calling that gentleman a moron. So we can argue about that, but yes, I'm saying as long as I can run Linux on top of Windows, or Windows on top of Linux, creating the awful beast Lindows, a walking, talking trademark infringement, either of these is fine for my purposes of allowing asocial nerds to code what they want and have no gatekeepers say what they can do about it, and they can spread it all around to the rest of us. You take the generative internet together with the generative PC, and you get the explosion of the 1990s that has been so vaunted. And some of them, some of the innovations came from existing incumbents, you know, Barclays or whoever, Consumer Reports gets online, CNN. Others came from just two guys, right? A Swede and Estonian pair up, and they create Kazaa, and they basically mortally wound the music industry. And when they are done, they're like, what should we do next? Let's kill the telecommunications industry. And the same guys make Skype. The same guys. And then when they're done, they're like, what should we do next? TV. So they do Joost, J-O-S-T. Like, now they're taking that on. If the publishers were just to kill these two guys, you could go back in time kind of thing. I would have made a very different future. Or if in 2001, a man named Jimbo came up to you and was like, I got a great idea. They start with like 20 articles. Then anybody can edit anything at any time. It's an encyclopedia. Right. Your reaction would be like, what the hell are you talking about? And, you know, there's a man named Jimbo sitting right here. That's pretty much how it went down, right?
That's about right.
That's about right. That's how it went down. And then it's like, okay, let's try it out. And somehow the bumblebee flies. Wikipedia has now become so prevalent that I am pleased to say you can find it on a Chinese restaurant menu. You can have stir-fried Wikipedia, stir-fried Wikipedia with pimentos, or steam eggs with Wikipedia. I'd like to believe it's the dish that anyone can edit. Which makes you wonder if you'd eat it.
I asked Chinese people, I said to them, I said, I saw this and I don't know what this means. I said, can you explain it to me? And they said, Jimbo, we don't know what this means.
I have a theory, but we'll save it for question and answer. So just as there's generative stuff done by poorly dressed nerds here, it gives rise to software here, like the wiki, that then other nerds or non-nerds like Jimbo can take and do generative things at the content layer that allow people to come together to make content, even if they're not nerds, which then can change things at the social layer. It goes all the way up the tree and creates this cascade of the generative stuff I'm talking about. Way at the top, a social example of this, couchsurfing.net. Are there couch surfers present here? Yeah, a couple couch surfers. What's the basic idea of couch surfing? Freeloading, says Susan Crawford, says Professor Crawford. It's freeloading. As I understand it, it finally has found a solution to that market failure of people who want to sleep on strangers' couches when they're in a weird city, and people in weird cities who have couches that they'd like strangers to sleep on. Who would have thought? And yet now couch surfing brings over 250,000 of them together in harmony. Now, your first reaction to this might be, cool, I'm there. I think many people's first reaction to this are, how many people have died using couchsurfing.net? Because it's only the survivors that come to the thing. And that sense of a generative facility, I claim, is basically present throughout. This is a collective hallucination, just like the internet is a collective hallucination in a way that CompuServe was not. The PC software community, a collective hallucination that assumes that people are reasonable, that they're nice, that what you get from a stranger is likely to be something helpful and mutually reinforcing rather than something harmful. That assumption turns out to have some flaws, especially when it hits the mainstream. And that's exactly what's happening to our information environment today, which I claim will lead a movement driven by ourselves back to sterile. So an example at the content layer. As recently as 2005, Business Week had to run an article like, you may not have heard of them, but blogs may change your business. I'll have to read on this. I'm clicking on the cover and nothing's happening. My favorite blog, catsthatlooklikehitler.com. All the stuff always starts off with the cats, and it's whimsical, right? These are some of my favorite Kittlers. This one is like, wow. That is a cat that has found his calling. So it starts off this way, but then it starts getting serious. People move in and see the real value of it. So, you know, Josh Micah Marshall can come up with Talking Points memo and single-handedly ignite the U.S. attorney schedule, a scandal for better or for worse. Or Global Voices initiated at the Berkman Center, can give the tools to facilitate people starting to blog from around the world in places like Burma or Kenya. And then when things go down, the mainstream media are actually turning to bloggers to help inform them about what's happening. It starts off with the fun, and then it gets elements of real gravity to it. But just as it goes popular, you see it have reason for subversion. These are just a handful of the many comments awaiting on my very modest blog, which is not about pharmaceuticals. And yet, spammers who have drugs to sell have found it useful to just leave one comment after another that if it can work its way onto my blog, will it produce links back to their own sites that Google will then crawl and think that those sites are very popular because everybody's talking about them. So the internet fights back. It comes up with the CAPTCHA, the squishy green word generated by a computer that, ironically, a computer cannot itself solve. So I can put this on my blog and say, at least be a human if you're going to leave a comment. I don't ask for much, but be a person. And to indicate that, type what you see. All right, great, that works for a little bit, but then the spammers fight back. They use the generative internet, and they realize that they can use it to hire people around the world who want to solve CAPTCHAs all day long. $2.50 an hour, you solve a bunch of CAPTCHAs, everybody's happy. But why pay $2.50 an hour when you can get it for free? So what do they do next? They set up sites containing free pornography. And there really is free porn there. There's just one catch. You have to type the squishy words you see before you get to the porn. Where do they get the image that comprises the squishy word? From my blog, where they want to leave a bloggy comment. So they then put the image there. The person types the answer. They take the answer, put it on my blog. They leave the comment. Person sees the porn. Everybody's happy. If that were a Nobel Prize for evil, I would award this a strong runner-up in the evil genius category. So this similar problem finds itself happening down at the protocol and hardware layers. The number of attacks on our machines, increasingly powerful, often idled, on 24/7, connected to really good broadband, means that you can find what Vint Cerf estimated to be 250 million PCs in the world right now, ready to follow the whims of whoever commands them from afar, unbeknownst to the holders of the PCs themselves. Because every PC these days is running a big pile of code. It's just a happy couch surfing family of fun. And you have no idea who any of these entities are and what the code will do. If any one of these executables has a single line on it, delete the hard drive, that's it. It deletes the hard drive. Or look for spreadsheets. And when you see them, transpose numbers randomly in the spreadsheet. And then your work is done. And 3 weeks later, somebody starts doing the payroll and realizing that nothing makes any sense. How many spreadsheets could you trust after that virus had been let loose in the world? You start seeing weird things like this, like discarded 24 scripts, where Network World, one of the world publications, who appear to have sponsored this talk, say that the Stormworm is fighting back against researchers that seek to destroy it. It retaliates by launching attacks against them, shutting down their access for days. As you try to investigate, it knows and it punishes. They're afraid. I've never seen this before. This is like weird stuff, and I say it's only going to get weirder. Our defenses against this are 1977 style. Basic perimeter defense, and you're supposed to know how to tinker so that your machine is in good shape. So, for instance, at Harvard, they sent around an email to the faculty and staff warning of an insurgence of fraudulent emails at the law school and a huge pile of advice about what you need to do if you're reading your email so as not to completely compromise your machine and everything on it by reading the wrong email and clicking the wrong link. My favorite piece of advice is to be weary of emails that have misspellings, poor grammar, or odd characters. I wrote back, I was like, I think I got one. And now I'm at Oxford. You see something like this while you're surfing. Quick pull of the room, right? You're about to go to a website. One of these things pops up. Do you want to proceed? How many say yes? Right. How many say no? One guy in the back. How many say the Dark Horse candidate view certificate? Yeah, so Esther Dyson's like, I view the certificate. What happens when you view the certificate, Esther?
It depends who it is.
Yeah, you get a certificate. It's like, well, all right, it's a certificate. And you have to really do some research to try to figure out whether it's a problem or a threat or a menace. So my favorite new technology that does not only not seem to have solved this problem but made it worse is the Vista speech recognition hole. Now, instead of having to elbow your mouse over to the folder and click, you can say, open the folder, and it opens the folder automatically. So now there are websites, you just visit the website, and it suddenly blares out of your speakers, delete the hard drive. You're like, no, don't delete the hard drive. Yes, delete the hard drive. And you're in this like existential battle with an unseen foe over the existence of your machine. It's profoundly weird. Here's Chuck Roast, which counterintuitively sells fleece. You visit the site for 10 seconds and realize you don't want the fleece. It doesn't matter. Chuck Roast's site got hacked. It has exactly one extra line of code deposited by a robot. It's a line of code that opens up a window of zero width and height, a diminishingly small window, and then deposits into it the contents of the counterintuitively named iShakurPages.net, which contains the worm. That's it. You visit the site, you're dead. Your computer completely owned by whoever put this in, and you don't even know who it is. It's not a tenable state of affairs, and yet it's completely normal. We take it as a matter of course. Oh, yes, you know, your computer can be completely run and taken over by anyone at pretty much any time, and yeah, I just patch regularly. That's what we say. The fundamental problem is represented by this, the Cap'n Crunch bosun's whistle, a prize in a box of Cap'n Crunch cereal in the early 1970s. After you've sugared up your child, why not have her run around the house and blow the whistle? It's like the perfect partners. Turns out, of course, if you cover one hole of the whistle and blow, it generates a tone at 2600 hertz, exactly the tone used by AT&T to indicate an idle line on the Monopoly telephone network. Pick up the phone, blow the whistle, free long-distance telephone calling. Wow. Boxes of Cap'n Crunch cereal are flying off the shelves. General Mills has a VisiCalc moment. a new third-party app for our cereal. Now, AT&T wasn't supposed to have a generative network. It was supposed to be sterile, not reprogrammable by third parties. So they could fix this. They did. They invented out-of-band signaling, so no sound you could utter could change the way the network worked. The internet, on the other hand, is supposed to be generative. There is no easy way to make it so that the pathways that carry our images, our web pages, our emails, our sounds, don't also carry executable code intended for our machine to run. That's the whole point. There is no easy way to solve the Cap'n Crunch problem with today's PCs and internet. And yet, if we don't solve it, my claim is we will migrate away from this. We will see the end of the PC as we know it. It will start in cyber cafes and corporations where if you want a flying toaster screensaver, forget it. You have to make a case to the IT department to be allowed to make any edits to the way your machine operates. And then we'll ask for it ourselves. Because more and more, all you really need is a browser. Who cares what else is running on the machine? The browser is the gateway to the world and to all the applications and data that you need. And there's a whole range of other devices out there that are not fully generative, clamoring for your attention that you would normally be devoting to the general purpose machine here. There's a whole movement of things inspired by inventions done on the PC, but then that buff them and shine them and make them user-friendly in a good way. I love my TiVo. And yet, it's not generative, even though it's got Linux inside screaming to get out. Same with the BlackBerry. Same with many, but not all, significantly mobile phones. Does this look at all familiar? Yeah. The Amazon Kindle. It's cool. Also sterile. Certainly the iPod here in its pink native Naugahyde case. The iPhone. Completely gorgeous work of art. And, you know, I think CompuServe could sue for copyright infringement on their main menu, even though the icons are much prettier. Steve Jobs does not apologize about this. He says, of course the point is to find everything on the phone. You wouldn't want it to be like a PC, because then it'll suck. People are like, oh, yeah, that's why I want the iPhone. It will work, for God's sake. So I see, in some ways, these new devices as being a direct connection back to the era of the Friedan Flexowriter and to the Hermann Hollerith model of computing with the people in the lab coats running interference in order to help you. An era that takes us into turf that is profoundly weird. I know I keep saying weird, but that's the term I'm going to use for it. Because it's not just a move to the past. It's a move to what I call tethered appliances, because they've learned something from the internet revolution. They're not just saying, all right, you'll buy it and the iPhone will work the same way the last day you have it as the first. No, while you can't easily change it, they can. The vendor has special privilege to reprogram the way it works at any moment. It's like going down to breakfast and finding your toaster has a third slot. Congratulations, it's the spring update to your toaster. I'm like, that's convenient. And you kind of like back slowly away from your toaster, right? Like maybe in the summer it'll start making orange juice. And again, it's like, well, you're trying to help me out, I realize, but what did I buy? Did I buy a toaster? I guess I bought a relationship with Amana in which they will try to make my breakfast better. That's kind of weird. And it also means that their ability to reach in after the fact and change things can be used by regulatory bodies that previously really did find the internet to be ungovernable. Two quick examples. This is the EchoStar DVR and dish system. It rips off that part of TiVo that allows you to record shows. So great. TiVo sues them for patent infringement for doing this. They sue in Texas. They win. They get $90 million judgment against EchoStar. But then in briefs under seal, they ask for more and they get it. They get an order from the judge that says to EchoStar, within 30 days, you guys have to remotely disable the DVR functionality in all but a handful of the units already in living rooms around the world. Send a new special update that turns the EchoStar into an Echo brick. That's weird. And you realize that once you can just kill it, you could do something far more refined. Find me a piece of The Simpsons that infringes copyright or that defames somebody, and we can remotely update it to simply remove that defamatory slice from all TiVos on which it is parked. Or how about this example? Some people might have the OnStar system in their cars. It gives you GPS functionality and a special rearview mirror microphone coupled with speakers in the ceiling so that if you run into trouble, you press this help button and you say, help, help. And then this lady, this is actually the lady, is like, I see you've fallen and you can't get up. We know just where you are. We're sending help. Great system. Peace of mind. The FBI noticed this system, and as a result, the FBI asked an anonymous company to reprogram the EchoStar system, sorry, the OnStar system, of a car containing people of interest to the FBI so that when they turn on the car, the microphone just automatically goes on and transmits everything back to the FBI. Wow, that's cool. That gave rise to the wonderfully titled case, The Company versus the United States of America, where the anonymous company bravely sued in order to say that the wiretap laws should not allow this. They lost in the district court, at least I think so. The decision's under seal. They took an appeal, and the Ninth Circuit found that the company should win on the slimmest of reeds. What was the rationale? Well, the way the FBI asked for it to be programmed, at all times it goes to the FBI, even when you ask for help, at which point the FBI is not going to come and help you, which could be a problem if the bad guys fall and can't get up. So if you could reprogram it so it goes to the FBI all the time, except when they ask for help, at which point the lady gets conferenced in, no problem. You also see ways in which the FBI has said, great, we can do this with mobile phones as well, right? Why not just reprogram them to turn on the microphone and capture all ambient noise? And all you notice is that your battery life isn't what it used to be. But even when you're on a call, it's broadcasting up what's going on. And you suddenly realize that through our consumer choices, we have built an infrastructure of surveillance far more thorough than anything done by straight-out government purchasing CCTV cameras on the streets of London. And while it's true, you may not think that's an issue in a place like the United States where the rule of law has been, is, and will always be fully respected. I'm with you. I don't credit any of the reports of the Bush Justice Department Inspector General who said that national security letters had been abused. I just don't believe that. On the other hand, in China, here you have mobile phones and cars rolling off the assembly lines with these technologies in them. CEO of China Mobile, the biggest mobile phone provider in China, was at a conference in January talking about advertising and how he was working it onto his platform. He was so excited, he said, yeah, we can do so much to personalize it. We can even tell you how many people attended a sporting event, and we can say who was there on the basis of their mobile phone signals. And he's like all excited. Everybody else in the room was like, And then a guy asks a question. He says, isn't there a privacy issue with this? And the CEO says, no, of course not. We keep privacy very well protected. We only tell the government. So, kind of worrisome. So what do we have falling straight ahead? We have what I call contingently generative technologies. Technologies that basically take the tethered appliance I've just been talking about and put it into the web. Remember I said, as long as we have a web browser, we're free? Well, I'm actually very worried about that. See, here's the non-generative iPod. All right, already hackers start getting to work, or outsiders, generative things that just poke into the schnozzle here, so you have this like mewling dog that dances vaguely in syncopation with the music. Right? This is a $3 billion a year market. This is a $1 billion a year market. Who would have guessed? I mean, it's gotten so ubiquitous that the British have now produced a destroyer with iPod docks and surround sound throughout. Cost of the destroyer, $1 billion, doubling the market in iPod accessories in only 1 year. So then Steve Jobs comes along, and I was wondering, right? The book is just getting released. I used the iPhone as an example in my introduction. I'm like, shit, is the software development kit going to be all generative? And then I'm like, oh, all right, thank you, Steve, which I should really be happy about, but you know what I mean. But no, Steve Jobs delivered. The software development kit for the iPhone that people are so excited about is such that if you write new software using this kit, as some people in this room have done, you have to get it to other people. You can't beam it from your iPhone to theirs. You can't send them a floppy disk. You have to put it through the iPhone apps store, where Steve Jobs takes a cut. Okay, if you want to charge nothing, he takes a cut of nothing. But he also reserves the right not to allow your software in his store, which means not on any iPhone, or to retroactively kill it for any reason whatsoever. What reasons might those be? Well, once again, Steve Jobs has a way of fuzzing all photos of him. But here he is just a couple weeks ago introducing the SDK. And what are the limitations of his app store? Illegal, malicious, privacy, porn, bandwidth hog, and the wonderful dark horse candidate, unforeseen. We wouldn't want anything unforeseen to happen on the iPhone. That's what I call a contingently generative technology that lures the nerds in knowing they won't read the fine print and then bops them on the head the minute they do something that might actually be game-changing. So when a friend of mine earlier, when I was talking about the security problems I'm worried about, said, you know, we license our cosmetologists. Before somebody can shampoo your hair, they need a license from the state. And yet we think we live in a free society. Why shouldn't we license our coders? Because what they're doing is far more significant than a wash and dry. And I was like, well, that sounds unfree, which was not really a persuasive argument back to him. But then I realized in some ways the argument is moot, because we are building, without the help of the state, a licensing regime for coders through exactly these contingently generative technologies like the tethered iPhone, or like Web 2.0 software as service platforms like the Facebook Apps platform. Facebook Apps platform lets people develop new code for the thing, but they have the right at any time, in their sole discretion, to just kill your app and just send you packing. They reserve a right to charge a fee at any time for your software running on their machine. Can you imagine if Bill Gates said on Windows, you know, Intuit, this Quicken that you've been working on is tremendous. It's been a good 5-year run for you guys. I'd like $1 million. And Quicken's like, okay. He's like, great, I'll see you next Wednesday. And I mean, it would be weird, right? And yet this is exactly what our instincts tell us is perfectly fine with Facebook. It's Zuck's platform. He can do what he wants with it. Let the market sort it out. You also, by the way, represent Warren and Covenant that the platform application content will not be obscene, defamatory, fraudulent, otherwise illegal in any jurisdiction. So if you're doing the Insult the Thai King Facebook app, I would recommend you do it elsewhere. But it also solves the problem, in a bad way, I say, but it does solve it, that I was talking about at the beginning. So the Secret Crush Facebook app, one of the most popular Facebook applications that I've never found a single soul admitting to installing, was said to be installing adware. So that gets reported on Wired's blog on January 3rd, and by January 7th, Facebook has dumped the Secret Crush retroactively. That's it. No more Secret Crushes for anybody. And it's like, well, that's good, right? Well, yeah, I guess it's good, but then you also realize that when an app comes along like Scrabulous that does not have spyware in it, but it does insult Hasbro, Hasbro can come along and say to these two brothers from India, who I won't say whether they're poorly dressed, but they are smiley asocial nerds, as far as I can tell, highly intelligent, they say to Hasbro, come find us in India, like your jurisdictional tendrils won't come this far. Hasbro says, forget it. They go to Facebook and say, kill Scrabulous. And Scrabulous, I say, hangs in the balance. Maybe they'll cut a deal. But if they don't, Hasbro has tools to kill it that they would never have dared try to use with Bill Gates if there were an application like Grokster or Kazaa that they were saying were infringing their legally protected interests. So just 2 days ago, we see the introduction of the Google Apps platform, exactly consonant terms of service with the ones I was just describing. You can build your apps on it. They're going to be cool. This icon is just gorgeous, right? Although it has a kind of threatening quality to it as well. I wouldn't want to get caught in there. But they can kill it at any time. You guarantee the content will be clean. And that's it. If they want to charge you a fee, they can. So, all right, what do we do about this? I'm just going to offer a couple thoughts on it so that we can open up to discussion. But just enough to tell you, I'm not just here to say the world is ending. I'm here to say that with enough can-do spirit and gumption, we can overcome it, and the Jedi can strike back or whatever it is. What are those Ewoks? We'll be soon pacing the aisles and we'll feel vaguely nauseated. So to go a little academic for just a second, way too short a second, I say there's basically two axes at work here that you might think aren't supposed to be perpendicular, but that's the catch. On the left, you have hierarchy, and on the right, polyarchy. A single way of doing things or many ways of doing things, and then a market or choice decides which one will prevail along this axis. On this axis, you have top-down or sterile, and on the bottom, bottom-up or generative. And you can have things that fit into any of these categories. There are top-down polyarchical things. I would say CompuServe counts as that, because the people who are buying CompuServe, the subscribers, don't get to affect how it works. The subscribers are down here, CompuServe executives are up here. And yet CompuServe competes with AOL and everything else, the source. And in that sense, it's a polyarchy meant to deliver value to the customers, and often it does. So market people and firms are actually over here a lot of the time, I say. I'd put Internet Protocol actually over here. A bunch of bearded guys from LA dream it up and share it with other bearded guys. So it's sort of bottom-up. It's not like the International Telecommunications Union got together and said, let's build a network. They actually did, and it was unusable. It was these crazy guys, bottom-up, who did it. But everybody uses Internet Protocol, which in essence has made it a hierarchy. On the other hand, that little bit of hierarchy, that narrow piece of the hourglass, means you have the broad bottom and the broad top, allowing all sorts of competing technologies for how the hardware will work, and what applications will run. So a little bit of hierarchy goes a long way towards creating the space here. I'd put the government up here, or multiple governments integrated by a federalist system of the UN, maybe somewhere in the middle, but that's a top-down kind of thing. So my basic claim is good stuff over here until the party ends, until the first couch surfer gets killed. And when that happens, we either look for Pinkertons, for firms to come in and solve our problems, cash and carry, the way we do with Symantec, or we look for the government to come in and help us out and make a rule against killing people who are on your couch and try to enforce it. My interest is in this zone. When we have a problem that can't be solved in this quadrant, and there are some, I say, that fit that mold, what can we do over here that might be able to solve it, that preserves the generative basis, but it doesn't create its own new problems and doesn't have us having recourse up to here as we sometimes might have to do. There's a couple examples of that in the book. Again, I'll just say briefly, one example is a project started at the Berkman Center called StopBadware.org in cooperation with Google, HP, Sun, and Lenovo. And StopBadware has two pieces to it. One is a piece of software you can download to your machine. You download it to your machine, and it keeps track of the vital signs and reports them back up to the rest of the participating members of the herd. And then when you encounter software, you can say, all right, is this software new to the herd, or has it been around for years? Or you can say, does this software on average make a machine happier or sadder? Or you encounter a network blockage, and you say to the herd, I can't get there from here. What's going on? And the act of asking the question provides the answer if enough people around the world are asking. Because you can see everybody in Beijing is asking, and nobody in Washington is asking. Perhaps there's an issue with filtering in China with respect to this site. Together, we can actually produce a site that starts to answer the question, what's filtered around the world? And the $5 million multiple year OpenNet initiative that entails, in part, sending people into Beijing to ask for a bunch of websites and get out before they get arrested, can be implemented generatively through the very people. We are the change we've been waiting for kind of thing. Let the network be the people comprising the network. The other piece of Stop Adware very quickly is we take sites like Chuck Roast and in conjunction with Google, we enumerate them. Just under 300,000 sites found, like Chuck Roast, waiting to spring on the unwary browser. And when we find them, not only do they get listed here at Stop Badware, but Google will take action so that if it comes up in a Google search, you'll be warned. So our great colleague Yochai Benkler wrote The Wealth of Networks, bumper sticker, amateurism good. He puts this thing up onto the net in a wiki because he eats his own dog food. The wiki gets edited by a bad guy to have a virus in it. So you come for The Wealth of Networks but stay for being pwned. And what happens? Well, now Google says when you search for it and it comes up as a result, this site may harm your computer. Maybe you're brave and you click anyway. It still won't take you to the site. It takes you to this page that says, no, really, you don't want to go to this website. Here are some suggestions. Have a cream soda. Or if you're just a total nutcase, you can copy and paste this thing into the browser bar. This single act completely changes the equities of online security. Suddenly, when Chuck Roast gets listed this way, 90% of his traffic evaporates. And now he's calling us saying, how can I fix my site? How did this happen? What's going on? It also makes him write me and say that I've created the Gitmo of the internet because the appeals process is slow and unclear. When you're doing stuff down here that creates a hierarchy that can rain on Chuck Roast's parade, he wants to know, where does he appeal, right? How many months have to pass when you don't pay your water bill before the state will finally cut you off? Up here, there are some advantages. If you're the little guy, you've got your constitutional rights. Down here is the area also of vigilante justice. So I'm not singing uniform praises down here. I'm just saying there's very cool stuff that can be done together if people are working on it. I know that community-oriented or wisdom-of-the-crowd mechanisms can be subverted. People might be using Dig. They might be using it right now, for all I know. And then they might go to the site subvertandprofit.com, where you can buy digs at $2 a dig. You have something you want to promote, like a book, $1,000 gets you 500 digs, away you go. And the diggers themselves sign up to get a referral so they can go click on a site and earn one of those $2. That is worrisome. It's also, to me, not the end of the story. Just as Wikipedia could get vandalized and abused, it has learned to fight back. It has learned to develop some rules and practices to preserve this corner without yet having to resort up there. That's the kind of community-oriented processes that blend the naivete of the earlier years with some of the cynicism that's necessary today that I say can stop a future that doesn't have the state coming in automatically to save us all from ourselves. Thank you very much. So I guess we have a little bit of time for questions. JP, what do you suggest? We have a mic if we need it. I don't know if people have reactions, questions, thoughts. Yes, Solana Larson.
No anonymity in this room. Solana. No.
You might just have to bellow.
Do you think we might... Do you think we might be able to get people to do good deeds online by showing them free porn?
But actually, we can get them to do deeds online by showing them free porn.
But actually, more seriously...
Well, that wasn't really the question. Damn the cheap laugh line, yeah.
Do you think maybe, I mean, some of these bad things that are happening help drive innovation? I mean, I know that, you know, we know the founders of Wikipedia, we might know the founders of Facebook, we might consider them, you know, our friends because we've watched them grow, we've been a part of their growth process, but maybe, you know, maybe it's not bad that they get subverted or that people are driven to create new things, that maybe big is bad.
I respect the idea that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. There is a problem that whatever does kill you kills you, and I think there is a parallel for that. As some of the hobbyist spirit of 1977, where to own a PC was to struggle, and the struggle was the point. The journey was the destination. And I think it's true for a lot of people doing iPhone apps today. It's in that whimsical stage. But once it goes mainstream and mission critical, and, you know, you find out that a battleship is running NT server, like 4.0 or 2.0, it's like, that's profoundly unsettling, that you... you realize that if enough people don't join you for the, hey, even if it's bad, it might be good, that we'll lose the ability to push out to grandma and to corporate platforms the kinds of innovations that only catch on when everybody or many, many, many people can use them. So I don't want a world where the nerds retreat to an Ayn Randian golden valley like at the end of Atlas Shrugged, and they mow each other's lawns while the rest of the world descends into hell. I think, or into iPhone. I mean, not to equate iPhone with hell. It's a very nice form of a brave new world. But I want that experimentalist spirit to remain just the way you do. I just think we need some innovative solutions to recognize how mission critical it's become as well and to preserve it. And I have a couple ideas on that front to try to split that difference.
And over a drink, you can tell
something. And over a drink, we can say more. Esther Dyson?
Could you just talk a little more in a very practical way about the Google appeals process, the Stop Adware appeals process that you just sort of touched on at the end, and the costs of it, which in some sense are the costs of security?
We get, I think, what happens is basically at the moment, Google identifies the bad sites with a robot, an implacable robot, just like Eye of Sauron kind of thing, but in a good way, that identifies bad sites. And then we end up with a list at the Berkman Center. And part of our job that we're doing, because we think it is academically interesting and in the public service, is to handle appeals from people like Chuck Roast who've been listed by the robot. And their first reaction, it's like totally the AA steps, is denial. Like, my website is fine. It's all those other people that got hacked. I don't know what you're talking about, but this is an outrage and I'm going to sue you. It's basically, we could have a letter-writing wizard for people who get listed that actually puts in the insults and imprecations at the right spaces. We handle, I believe, on the order of 3,000 appeals a week. And that's a lot. And it's because it's so new, this whole mode of dealing with it, it's like, who should bear that initial burden? Like, should we list the site and ask questions later and sort it out? Because every second it goes unwarned, another angel is killed as he or she visits with an unpatched browser. Or do you give the webmaster the benefit of the doubt and let them fully litigate it upwards before you say, all right, now you're bad, and they've run away? Exactly the kind of problem with the Canned Spam Act. By the time the FTC gets you, you know, you've already wreaked your havoc. So with that kind of volume, it's awfully hard to staff a customer service line that starts helping people through this appeals process. We've tried to split the difference by automating as much as can be automated, handling what we can handle within a 10-business-day queue, which, trust me, the number of websites that say, we're just about to unveil our new website tomorrow, how dare you tell us it's 10 working days. We need a solution for this that I think has got to come from the crowds, just like if Wikipedia tried to solve the problem of vandalism by having a staff of people hired to handle 3,000 vandalism appeals a week. We need to find a way to push it back out, and it's hard work. I agree with that. Yeah.
Hi, Donna Bogatin, startupalpha.com. I actually, in my blog, said the same thing about Google App Engine, I recommend that startups not rely on Facebook or Google for exactly the same types of changes. So it seems at this point, the innovators are not innovating. They're actually treating the internet as if 10 years ago incumbents like Time Warner and things, they're thinking, Facebook, Google, YouTube, if we can't work with them, we can't do anything.
Right.
So it seems like innovation, the geeks are self-inhibiting themselves.
Yeah. Well, I think the geeks will code wherever it's fun to code. One of the geeks I was talking to recently, who shall remain nameless, wants to use the iPhone app platform because it's just so cool. It's just her aesthetic. And I respect that. But what we need then are the geeks to actually, for a moment, get a bit of a quasi-political consciousness and make it clear through their market actions that, you know, Google, we'd really love you to find some ways to cut the tether sometimes, to bind yourself, to tie yourself to the mast and say, these kinds of apps can run forever, and we'll either promise it as a legal matter or we'll design the technical architecture so that can be so. I think a lot of the restrictions in the Facebook platform I point to, in the Google platform, it's like, just what if we were hired as lawyers to write their terms of service? The default rule you do is preserve all the rights just in case you never know, you might want to charge a fee someday. Why give away what you don't have to? But if they push back, just like with a privacy policy, all right, you're willing to do something just as people push back on Google as to how long they retain identifying information for the searches that people do. So part of what I'm calling for is
a market reaction that's a little more informed, after having read the book, of course, that lets people have that kind of dialogue with a Google and a Facebook and then use the platforms for the coolness that they offer.
Should we take one more between you and the open bar?
Well, when you put it that way.
maybe in the back, since I've had...
I'll try to talk about it. Currently, if I'm a bit of a geek and I say use Linux, I have more control. I can, if I'm really a coder, I can actually look at the program code because it's open source and understand how it works. If not, I can have somebody smarter than me check it out. And I can also have the security because I can basically use a checksum to determine that when I download software, it is exactly what it is supposed to be. That's because I actually can be...
Yes, you're what they would call in the UK a boffin.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So I own my own computer and I can be the systems administrator. Now, currently we're moving from that to the cloud, to Web 2.0 types of services.
Correct.
And companies like Google, with Google Apps, use open source software to make closed source software based services.
Yes.
So my question is there somewhere we can get sort of a best of all worlds environment where there's that accountability in terms of the inner workings of the software, yet it still is provided, you know, in the cloud and gives you the good things of the internet and that kind of...
I would certainly like to believe that. I certainly don't mean my argument to say cloud bad, desktop good, any more than I mean to say iPhone bad, Packard Bell PC good. I want to see a diverse ecosystem, and it may well be that parking stuff in the cloud really is a great thing, because then if you lose your computer or get stolen or something, it's great to have the data out there.
Right.
But we haven't at all thought through, politically, the ways in which the differential architectures lead to differential legal results. Like the Fourth Amendment applies far less to Gmail than it does to Eudora. And it's like, what? Like, why should there be this weird subsidy to Eudora if you're paranoid that they need a warrant to seize your Eudora mail, but it's a mere business records request if they want to get at your Gmail? So I think there are ways to tweak the law and to tweak the architectures so that cloud computing can work perfectly well. My encouragement to Facebook, which I think is in some ways ideologically on our side on this, again, a lot of it's just reflex, is to maybe even release the Facebook platform so that you can run a Facebook server and then have a bunch of Facebook accounts with the magic at sign. People are at that server. And people on Facebook at facebook.com, just like some people host WordPress blogs at wordpress.com, but you can also run your own WordPress install, can choose which other servers they want to even recognize as a galaxy in their universe or a star in their galaxy. So I do think there are architectures that will do it, and I think that's true all the way up the tree. So chapter 9 of the book talks a lot about privacy and how to solve the privacy problems that come from a generative environment in a similar kind of a way. How to solve it in that bottom left quadrant rather than the others.
Excellent. So Jonathan, thank you for this, and I hope everybody will join me in congratulating. You can buy it outside, right after signing Devil Boys up as a nice retainer. I hope you will all join us outside.